This is 91.7 FM's WHUS Stores. I am Peddlin' Ron, and you are listening to Bicycle Talk. It's November 1st, 2017. Welcome to Bicycle Talk, this week with my co-host, Fran Storch, a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you have a comment or you'd like to contribute information to the show, please call or text us at 860-486-9487, or you can email me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. You can also visit me at Bicycle Talk on Facebook. If you'd like to listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk, you can listen to them on whus.org or on iTunes. And if you'd like to contribute to or be on the show as a guest, please contact me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. Okay, we're going to start off the show with the infamous Ron's Rant of the Week. this is a tough one. It's a really tough day. It's November 1st. We had a major problem yesterday in New York City. And my rant of the week is going to be cowards who hide behind the wheels of motorized vehicles. Yes, cowards. That's who you are. That's what you're all about. The New York City terror attacks, inexcusable. Any terror attacks, inexcusable. But, of course, they hit home because this particular character, or coward, as we will call him, and as many people have been calling him, he ran into a bike path and a bunch of people on the bike path, and he mowed them all down, and it was just really a very, very terrible and tragic thing. And he was driving a rental truck, I believe. He had rented a truck from the Home Depot, and he decided to rage terror on a bunch of people who were walking in a bike path and also riding their bicycles in a bike path. No real reason other than the fact that he was a coward that liked to go out and kill people because he felt that it was his place in the world to do that. And you know, it strikes a tough point with me because it touches on the fact that there are people that go after people that are in bikes and bikes and pedestrians. And you know, it's not that you should attack anybody else. You really shouldn't do that. But what's the point? What is really the point? And I make mention of this because we are actually fairly safe out here in northeastern Connecticut where we live, so we don't usually have too many problems with people driving motorized vehicles that are after people that are riding their bicycles. So we don't have as much of an issue out here. But when we do, I always try to engage a conversation with them. And I don't engage a conversation by shouting and screaming. I try to engage the conversation by just saying, could you please pull over? I would love to talk to you about bicycle law. Very simple. If you want to know about bicycle law, go to your local Department of Transportation or to your local bicycle advocacy group in your state that you live in and reside, and look it up. Find the bicycle laws. Learn them. Learn the right way to deal with things. Most of them are the same as motor vehicle laws. So you are a vehicle, and think about it as being a vehicle when you are riding your bicycle. So get yourself very confident with the idea of knowing your bike laws so that if you need to have a conversation, you can have an intelligent conversation with someone and let them know exactly what it is that they are doing right or wrong, and call them out. Call them out on it. It's definitely a good thing to do. It makes us all safer. While I'm perusing through all this, I come to this crazy thing. In China, there are people that are running people over with their motorized vehicles, and then they're stopping and backing up and running them over again to make sure that they're dead. Now, that's just like, I don't know where to go with that. I don't understand that. But they seem to feel that that's the way that they should do things. So anyway, enough ranting about cowards. You know, cowards who hide behind vehicles, who hide behind the big metal box with wheels on it. I don't have any place for you. I don't have any patience for you. I don't understand why you would do anything like that. And I hope you just get smarter and go away. That's what I really hope.
Do we want to address it all? Remember when 9/11 happened, and mm-hmm. there part of it is, you know, we're like, why did you have to do that?
Right.
I mean, what a horrible, horrible thing to kill all those people. And yet, one of the deals is that around the world, people experience terrible attacks and things like that in a more often than we do. It's just that now this sort of thing is coming to the United States.
Like it's an everyday thing.
An everyday thing, yeah. Where it's more likely to happen. And it's just that we're not used to having attacks on our own soil like that. And there's certainly, I mean, obviously, this we call this person a coward, but this person comes from an ideology that part of the deal with this coward is the ideology that's promoted around the world by the United States.
Right.
And that's what creates this sort of thing, that there's there are people in the world who feel very justified in their hatred of the United States and what the United States stands for. And among those are people who come from cultures where it's very difficult to get ahead in any way, and they're just not happy with their lot, and they suffer from severe oppression. And this person probably came from that kind of a mm-hmm. background. I mean, it doesn't excuse what he did, but I just have to wonder if we had more of a one-world philosophy, that this sort of thing would be less likely to happen. That it's not just about preventing terror and, you know, preventing people from driving their Home Depot trucks on the bike path.
Right.
But it's also about, you know, globalizing. And we are in a really scary time right now because we have a president who is jingoistic and
We have a president who
isolationist.
Who has two thumbs that should not operate. But
yes. And so it is absolutely terrible and inexcusable what this person did. But I think one of the solutions is in naturopathic medicine, we talk about treating the cause.
Mm-hmm.
You want to prevent people from being able to drive on to the bike path, and you want to have tighter security. But you also want to treat the systemic problem, that oppression that people feel in other countries, so they're less likely to do it in the first place.
The problem with empires is empires try to impose their will upon others. And that's when, I mean, this is historical. This goes way, way back before the United States, way back before Great Britain. It goes way back. Whenever empires try to control things, people get upset. They don't want to have that happen. They don't want their culture changed. And I get it. I understand. We had a really great conversation this past weekend. We went to a party where we were talking to people that were not from this country. And you know, if you ever get a chance to talk to someone from another country, ask them about, you know, how they feel about the United States.
Yes.
And assure them that they're safe in giving you that information. You can always come across to let them know that. But it's very interesting to get a perspective of how people feel about different people in different lands and worlds. So
there are people who are less likely to travel to the United States now because of the way things are going here.
Right.
I mean, when Trump got elected, I had Canadian friends who said, "We're not going there. We're not coming to the United States."
Well, it used to be safer here, but it's not as safe as it appeared to be a few years back.
Right.
So things have changed. So I'm gonna, you know, that's it. You know, people who hate, if you have an anger management problem, go get some help. There's a lot of help out there for you. There's people out there that will talk you through it. They'll help you out. They can make you healthy again. It's a good thing. Better yet, ride your bicycle. You'll feel better. You'll be better for it. It just, you know, this is a bike show. This is what we talk about. Speaking of which, I'm going to go right to On a Positive Side. And on a positive side, I would like to talk, because we are closing in on this, and my friends at Bike Walk Connecticut are having their annual dinner and silent auction this Friday, November 3rd. The doors open at 5:30 p.m. It's at the Chrysalis Center on 255 Homestead Avenue in Hartford, Connecticut. And you can go to www.bikewalkct.org, and you can find information about that and get your ticket to go to it. It's going to be a really cool event. We're going to have some special guests there. Kyone Wolf from NPR is going to be the MC, And we also
She's our friend.
Yeah, Kyone's great. Hey, Kyone, I hope you're listening.
She wears a tiger suit.
Yeah, she did wear a tiger suit. It's absolutely true. Well, there you have a featured speaker, Karen Jenkins. She is the board chair from the League of American Bicyclists, and she will be there as our guest speaker. There is also the People's Choice Awards, and if you have someone that you would like to nominate for the People's Choice Award, somebody who is contributing to bicycles or walking or someone who's contributing within our society here, our local society here, that you think is making a difference in you know, how people see us, perceive us, whatever, and making a forward action, please feel free to go on to their website and nominate them so that they can get some recognition for that. So that's kind of a cool thing. Anyway, that's my positive thing right there, because it's a good organization. It would be really nice if you could support the organization. It is your choice to do so. But check them out once again at www.bikewalkct.org. The annual dinner is this Friday evening at 5:30 in Hartford. I'm going to move forward one more time here, and we are going to do the new piece that we started 3 weeks ago now, the Maintenance Minute. So the Maintenance Minute this week is not to do with your bicycle, but it is to do with your helmet. Check your helmet. There was a piece, again, from Bicycling Magazine, and they had a piece here on your helmet and the 7 ways to keep your helmet in good condition. So we'll hit that one first, just so we can go there. And you wanna protect your helmet from unnecessary impact. In other words, try not to use your helmet. But then again, since you are wearing it, there is a chance that you may use the helmet. But if you it can protect it from unnecessary impact, and that would be throwing it down the stairs at your house, or, you know, having it drop off of something, you want to try to avoid that. So make sure that you have a secure place to keep your helmet so that it doesn't bounce around a lot, because that every time you put impact on your helmet, you are compromising the helmet to a certain degree. So the next thing is to protect your helmet from extreme heat. A lot of people will be going to an event, and they'll carry their helmet in the back of the car with them, and they will get to their event, go out and do their ride. Then they put their helmet away. They put it in the back of the car. The car gets really hot. You're giving it a lot of extreme heat. It's probably not a great idea. If you could find some way of sheltering it from the extreme heat, that would be a much better way of doing it. So you shouldn't leave it on the dashboard or on the front seat of your automobile, especially during the hottest and sunniest summer days. And never, ever, ever run it through the dishwasher. Believe it or not, people wash their helmets in the dishwasher. That was a new one for me. I didn't realize that when I saw it.
Well, that would be the heat problem, right?
That would be a definite heat problem, yes. I mean, your helmet will be very, very clean. I put my water bottles occasionally in a dishwasher because you can get them very clean that way and get all the mold and things out. But anyway, keep your helmet away from spray paints and solvents. Yeah, they don't like that a whole lot because they are the helmet is generally a chemical-based product. It is made from products from the petroleum industry, and when you take other things like solvents and paint, you tend to break down the helmet. And you can actually, certain paints, if you were to spray them on a styrofoam, you would watch the styrofoam just shrivel up in front of your very eyes. So you want to avoid that. This one's interesting because I know a lot of people that do this, and I have done this. Don't attach protruding objects to your helmet. Well, you know, let's talk about that just for a second. You want to be careful when you're attaching a product to your helmet, but we do this because there's a lot of people that use GoPro cameras, and they'll put that on their helmet, which is kind of a cool thing to do because wherever you look, you have the camera going with you. There are also a number of people that are commuters and people that are riding at night, and they will put a headlamp on their helmet. So protruding helmets on, objects on your helmet, just do it with caution and try not to compromise the foam liner on your helmet when you're doing that. Wash your helmet with care. When washing your helmet, you should always use soap, water and mild soap, but never ammonia or bleach. Then you should always rinse it thoroughly and allow it to air dry. You shouldn't be submerging your helmet in water for long periods of time, even though most helmets must pass a submersion test to receive safety and certification. This can cause your helmet's materials to absorb water, affecting the adhesive and hardening the foam. And we don't want to harden the foam because that's what protects your head when you hit. In case of lice, don't use sprays. So lice can be a problem in kids' helmets, especially if they're shared among a class or a summer camp group. So you, according to the instructions from Giro and on their webpage, their helmet care webpage, if you're concerned about a bug infestation, do not use the spray of any type. Instead, place the helmet in an airtight plastic bag and leave it there for 48 hours. Then remove the pads, use a soft cloth or sponge with warm water and mild soap to clean the helmet's surface. Finally, discard the used pads and the plastic bag and request a set of replacement pads from your helmet's manufacturer. Oh, here's a great one. Don't try to repair your helmet after a crash. What do they call that, Fran? I think that's a duh. That's a D-U-H. So if your helmet crashes and it breaks, great. That's a beautiful thing because when it breaks, it disperses all that pressure that could cause major impact to your head off to the sides and not into your head. It's supposed to do that. It's supposed to break apart. Please, please, please do not replace it. So, not replace it. Repair it. Replace it for sure. Don't repair it. So those are things that you want to pay attention to. I also found a really cool site here called helmets.org, and it's all about helmets and bicycle helmets and when should I replace my helmet. This is a great question because there are different opinions out there as far as that goes, but here's a quick checklist that you can look over. Did you crash it? Replace it immediately. If you crashed your helmet, it did its job, it protected you. You can still think about it. You can still operate as a normal human being. Replace your helmet just right away. Don't ride on that helmet any longer. Did you drop it hard enough to crack the foam? Then replace it. Is it from the 1970s? Oh, my God. Replace it. Is it from the 1980s? Is it from the 1990s? Is it from the 2000s? Let's say the early 2000s. Replace it. Replace it, replace it. It's too old. It gets compromised after a while. Is the outside just foam or cloth instead of plastic? Replace it. Boy, we're definitely going back to the 70s on that one. Does it lack a CPSC, ASTM, or Snell sticker inside? If it doesn't have any of those, replace it. And if you cannot adjust it to fit you correctly, replace it. So these are things that you need to pay attention to. There are different helmet manufacturers that have different ideas about styles of helmets or replacement of helmets that they sell. I find within the industry, it does seem that there is a standard of if you've had it for 5 years, it's time to say goodbye to it, make it into a planter, do something with it. You know, you can be creative. You know, if it's a helmet you absolutely loved and you can't seem to find anything else that's like it, look around. There's a lot of great helmets out there. So there are certain companies that are now pushing the idea of every 2 years on the replacement of that helmet. I think that they're trying to sell more helmets. It is a very, very large helmet manufacturer that a lot of people know about. And they're now talking about 2 years. I think they're pushing the limit there a bit. So anyway, replace your helmet every 5 years, I would say would be a pretty good standard as far as that goes. And then there's, in researching this, I also looked and I saw there are a number of people that don't believe in bicycle helmets because there are issues that they say happen with them. One of the things here, and I have this, there's a website called bicyclesafe.com. www.ocean.com, and it has a number of different things in there. It's obviously it's something to do with Austin, Texas, by the looks of things here. And one of the things in this particular article was, what's wrong with bicycle helmets? And it says here, many readers are surprised that I don't make a big deal on the site of insisting that cyclists wear helmets, especially since wearing helmets is what most people equate with bicycle safety. The number one reason this particular gentleman, who is Michael Bluejay, that the number one reason he says here is focusing on helmets distracts people from what's more likely to actually save their lives, safe riding skills. You know what? I'm with him on this. Not a bad suggestion. Not that I'm telling you not to wear your helmet. Not that I'm telling you that I will even want to ride with you if you're not wearing a helmet. But let's look at safe riding skills. What a great idea. Beautiful. Number two reason, research has failed to show any net protective value of bicycle helmets. And he says here that's because while bicycle helmets help you in some ways, they hurt you in other ways. The problems cancel out the benefits, and there's no overall safety effect. Probably the main negative impact of helmets is that drivers pass helmeted cyclists more closely than unhelmeted cyclists because unhelmeted cyclists seem more vulnerable. And so helmeted cyclists are more likely to get hit. And that is from a University of Bath survey. That's what they found out, the research said. Number three here, the importance of place that it's placed on helmets has negative social effects. It paints cycling as a horrible, dangerous activity, and it's any wonder why few Americans chose to ride bicycles in that kind of climate. Cyclists who choose not to wear helmets get demonized as stupid, quote unquote, even though the research shows that they're not in any greater risk of overall risk than that of helmeted riders. And the C section on this is governments get motivated to pass mandatory helmet laws, which have always had the effect of decreasing the number of cyclists. This is irony, since the thing that's most correlated with cycling safely is the number of cyclists on the road. But the helmet laws result in fewer cyclists, making it more dangerous for those who remain. By the way, helmet laws and the automobile industry. Take a good look at that. I'll let you do your own research. Please get back to me on this. But I have looked into it, and maybe we'll run this on another show. But apparently, a lot of the helmet laws that are pushed very, very hard in different states are backed by the automobile industry. And the reason it's backed by the automobile industry, this is the conspiracy that goes along with it, is because if they can make it so it seems like it's dangerous to ride your bicycle and that you have to wear a helmet, less people drive bicycles, more people drive motorized vehicles. Amazing, huh? Little things that you pick up when you're wandering around on the lovely internet. So anyway, helmets. That's my tip for the week. It's going to be the maintenance minute goes is check your helmet. Let's talk, take a good look at that helmet. How long have you had that helmet? Check and see. So, a few weeks back, I had put out a request to people about weird things that you find on the road. Fran contributed last week with a very unusual contribution to this, and I've asked others to do the same thing. But this stemmed from an article which I pulled again. It was another piece from Bicycling Magazine from a person by the name of Bruce Hildenbrand, and it was called The 10 Weirdest Things He's Found on the Road While Riding His Bike. And I really I think that some of the things he found were really interesting, and some of them just kind of gave me a little ho-hum here, but I'm going to go through it. He said the best day was probably when he found a North Face Gore-Tex jacket. Well, that's one heck of a good find, I would say. So, yeah, give him credit on that one. That's pretty cool. The next thing he found, this is the 2013 Vuelta España champion Chris Horner found a large adjustable wrench. I also found one of those, And you know, I carried it back with me, and I had to kind of tuck it into my shorts because the jersey pocket wouldn't hold it. But anyway, that was another thing that was found. There are other things in here. I'm looking at some rubber gloves that were found. And so, you know, you never know what you're going to find on the side of the road. I don't know if I'd pick up the rubber gloves and bring them with me. A pair of shoes found on the side of the road, a pair of rock climbing shoes, apparently, was one of the things that were found. And this person also said, and they fit. That's very nice. Cold, hard cash. Money is always a great find. One day I was doing a ride with one of my workmates, and I spotted some green. We were about to start a long downhill, and I scooped it up and stuffed it in my jersey. I remember seeing a one on the bill, and when we stopped at my favorite candy store, I offered to use my found $10 bill and treat everyone. Imagine my surprise when it turned into a $100 bill. So cold, hard cash, definitely there. Another one here is they found a fender on the ride. So you never, and that's a bicycle fender, not a car fender, not a motorcycle fender, but a bicycle fender. Apparently it fell off of someone's poor bike. There's another one here that said he found a computer, a small box computer that was found dumped on a pile of garbage off of the side of the road, and it was not junk. It actually came back to life. This is the weirdest one I think so far. A human child. I wish, he says, I wish I had a picture of this find, as you'll quickly understand why. One of my all-time favorite rides, he does a 115-mile loop from his house on the West Coast down to Santa Cruz and back. And he was riding along a street in Santa Cruz when he happened on a one-year-old baby running and screaming down the sidewalk with his diaper drooped down over his knees. He leaned his bike up against a building and after about 30 minutes of searching, found his mother in her kitchen cooking lunch, oblivious that anything was amiss. So, a human child. Storage to carry more booty. Someone found a milk crate, which they could put on the back of their bike and pick up yet more booty to put to bring back on their journey. And where he said it all started, the first find that he had made, he found a looks like a tape measure on the side of the road. And that started the whole booty collection idea. So we put out onto the Facebook page for Bicycle Talk, I put a request out both with this show in previous weeks, and also on the Facebook page, and I got a number of people to respond. So first of all, I thank you very much for listening to the show. Secondly, I thank you for responding to your special booty finds on the side of the road. I have a find here from actually a friend of mine, Bruce Masterson, who lives over in Rhode Island, and he found a nice pair of pruning shears. So that's a tough find, because how are you going to carry that home? Now, if you have a touring bike and you have a rack on it, then you can put it on that, and that's one way of doing it. But definitely very difficult to stuff in your back pocket. And he said, I used to find porno mags and video boxes on the road. But and for some reason in southeastern Massachusetts fairly often. Thankfully, that has stopped. So thanks, Bruce, for contributing. Chris Page, while racing in Stage 3 of the Green Mountain Stage Race, he saw a guy stop and pick up a waffle iron. Now, that's some serious road booty. He finished the stage with it. And the comment after that is, that ought to tell you how far back in the pack I was. Thanks, Chris. Good comment. Our friend Cindy Bean said, a friend and I once found and returned a young woman's lost dog. And I'll bet that friend was probably Fran, was it not? Yeah, she's nodding over there, so I think that's a yes.
Yeah, it was very sweet. We were, I think Cindy was riding her bike home from the weekly ride, and I was riding back with her, and we saw a little tiny dog. It was like a Shih Tzu or something, and it was running in the middle of Bastbridge Road. And we're like, okay, this is no good. So, and the dog had a leash. Mm-hmm. So we got the dog and we started leading it onto Mansfield Hollow. And we started hollering to see if we could find its owner because we thought it had just gotten away. And, you know, we didn't get too far in Mansfield Hollow when a pretty distressed young woman came running toward us And it was her dog.
There you go.
And we made her day.
That is a good thing.
It was very nice.
See that? You never know what you're going to find when you're out riding your bike. It's a pretty cool
thing.
It's
a cute little dog, too.
Yeah. That was live booty, kind of like the person who found the baby. Very similar.
Found an actual baby?
Yeah.
In the road?
Yeah. You were immersed in something over there, and you missed that part of the story here. Sarah Webster Melanson found a nice pruning knife once.
Yeah.
So, very nice, Sarah. That's good. David Dunn found a 7 and a 9-millimeter ratcheting box set wrench. So, you know, one of those box wrenches that has the ratchets on both sides. So, that's pretty cool. And, of course, Fran contributed to this with her dead turkey story, which she gifted to a friend for ceremonial purposes. Her friend Charisse used the feathers to do some ceremonial things that she does. And last on my list, no, not last on my list, I have another person here, Gregory Allen, and he said a friend found $200 blowing down the side of the highway. How about that? You're not going to see that while you're driving your motorized vehicle, but you sure will when you're riding your bike. Another great reason to ride a bike. Joseph Kidd, hey Joe, found a former UConn graduate, by the way. Found $194 rolled up in a rubber band in the middle of an intersection. Booty. Major booty. Tim Roix, outside of a few tools and a returned cell phone, he found $20 in the road. More booty. So I guess I was paid for the day to bike to work. So there you go. There's a reward. You're riding your bike to work and you find $20 on the side of the road. And what a cool thing. So anyway, that's more road booty stories. If you have more road booty stories to share, please do share them because it's very interesting. You never know what people are going to find and what they're going to share with us. I think the people that get all the money and they share, I think we should have a little party and maybe celebrate their find on the road with all your other cyclist friends. Just a suggestion, Joe. That's all. But anyway, Fran shared something really cool with me, and she sent it over to my Bicycle Talk Facebook page. And so I'm going to tell you that you need to go there to take a look at this if you get a chance. You might want to go to the Bicycle Talk Facebook page because here's the deal. There is, in Iceland, they're putting these crosswalks in on the road. And the crosswalks, you know, they look, if you look at them from one side, they look like a normal crosswalk where you see the stripes going across the road. And, you know, you would walk across them, cross on your bicycle walking or walking in general. If you face them from the road as you were driving a bicycle and or a motorized vehicle, they're three-dimensional. And because they're three-dimensional, they look like they are elevated up off the road. They look like they're actually like these big blocks in the road. And it's just a three-dimensional, you know, it's a trick on the eyes. It's a really cool thing. And if you get a chance, go to my Facebook page and check it out because it's so cool. And I even attached a little video there which shows them walking around this particular crosswalk in different directions, so you can see how the actual effect happens where it makes it look three-dimensional. It's just paint, and it's very, very cool. I think we need more of these. I like this idea a lot. So 3D crosswalks in Iceland, awesome idea. Love to have everybody sharing that one and see more of those out there because it really does make you slow down when you see the crosswalk because you think you're going to hit the bottom of your motorized vehicle on it or even your bicycle too. So there we have that situation where that way you're a little more careful when you're riding your bike not to run over a pedestrian when they're in a crosswalk. Not that anyone should run over anyone in a crosswalk, but It is a very clever idea. Whoever came up with that, we give them three thumbs up on that. I only have two, but three thumbs up. And I just think that's just kind of a cool thing. So that's definitely a subject here that we needed to talk about. I also have another subject today that I'd like to talk about, and it's the 2018 Tour de France. Because the route was announced a while back, October 17th. And this comes out of Velo News. And it says the 2018 tour route, Froome faces a steep challenge. So They changed it up a little bit. I think they're trying to knock this guy off his bike, because, or at least off the podium, because they put together a route that is potentially unfavorable to the reigning champion. It starts way up off the coast, and it lacks a long, flat individual time trial where the former winner, Froome, often pulverizes his opponents. There are six mountain stages, four hilly stages packed into the latter part of the tour before it ends on the Champs-Élysées in Paris on July 29th. It's different every year, and it's difficult every year. That's what Chris Froome said. And he also said, "I look at the Alpe d'Huez stage. For me, that's the queen stage of this tour," he added, referring to the potentially decisive stage. The Alpe d'Huez has been a factor for years and years and years, and it's a very interesting climb. I've had friends that have gone over and done it, and they said the difficult part of the Alpe d'Huez is not the 6% climb that it is. It's a long 6% climb. It's that at the very bottom of the Alpe d'Huez, before you get to the 6%, it's over 10%. And that's where it sort of takes your legs out, and then you've got to settle into this 6% climb for an extended period of time. So it is quite difficult. And anyway, he talks about there's going to be some wind when they're up on the coast, but they're used to that. And then there are going to be some cobbles put in that he wasn't counting on. And he raced the Paris-Roubaix in the past, and it's, you know, he's not real big on the whole cobble thing. So such relentless hill and mountain terrain may well grind down Froome's protective entourage that has so successfully snuffed out attacks in recent tours. And the British sprinter Mark Cavendish said he was not looking into the hilly challenge. So there's lots of sprint opportunities early on, but in the second bit, I'm not sure I'll get that far, said Dimension Data Rider with the 30 Tour de France stage win to his name. So Mark Cavendish is also not looking forward to this, but people like the Brit Simon Yates, he won the best rider competition last year's tour. He had other concerns. He said, "I'm a very light man, so I'm not looking forward to the wind," in Vendée, who rides for Orica Scott. So on top of that, teams will be allowed just 8 riders in 2018. By the way, this is a little piece of controversy that's out there. They are no longer going with 9 riders. It is now 8 riders. It's a new rule this year. So less teammates to help you out. Could run into a problem if there are crashes. So maybe, and this is why, here's the controversy to this. This is kind of interesting. The reason why they are dropping down to 8 riders instead of 9 riders is the UCI has determined that if there are less riders, they will be more careful, and because they don't want to be missing any more riders in the tour, so they'll be a little bit more careful. So they're doing it. Their concern is safety, and they're supposedly doing this to make the tour safer. That's what I read. If anybody has any input to that, that'd be great. Give it to me. I'd love to hear it. But yeah, should there be 8 riders in the Tour de France or 9 riders in the Tour de France? I'll let you guys be the people who decide that. Let's see how everybody feels about it. I think that it's probably a pretty good decision. I really don't think it's going to make the tour any safer. I think that what really makes the tour safer is to take away some of these, you know, treacherous descents on really, really narrow roads. Those are tough. We've had some incidents. And I love the climbs. I love the descents. I love to descend myself. I find it thrilling. But the question is it a good thing to have in the race? Are cobbles a good thing to put in a race of this magnitude? These are other questions we need to answer. The big one, though, the one that really concerns me, if I can throw my opinion into this, and that is when you're coming into these little towns, and remember, these towns are actually bidding to have the tour come through their towns. When you're coming into some of these towns, there are so many twists and turns, 90-degree left-hand turns, 90-degree right-hand turns, hairpins, all these crazy things coming into the towns, And it's just, it's not safe. It's, you know, there's just too much twisting and turning. And when they're coming into the towns, this is usually a finish line situation, by the way. I might clarify that. It's usually a finish line situation. They're coming into these towns, and they're looking for the win. So there's a lot of people that take a lot of chances going into these towns. And, you know, a smart rider, if they're able to pull it off, will try to get away before coming into the town, therefore being able to navigate the turns with more precision and more speed. But then you get these big groups going through, and we're just seeing a lot of mass crashes towards the end of the races. And, you know, maybe we need to take another look at that, because I don't know if that's really a wonderful idea. So that's what I have right now from the Tour de France for next year. I think that it's something that, you know, we need to discuss a little bit about. I'd like to hear your opinions and views out there. You can do that by contacting me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com, or you can go onto my Facebook page for Bicycle Talk, and you can put your comments there. I will put a post out on the Facebook page, too, to see if we can get some reaction on that. So I found this other thing, which I like to talk about this a lot, because there's so many people that are out there riding their bicycles that really don't understand how to ride in traffic. The League of American Bicyclists has a great explanation for this, and I really, really like it, and I've also heard a few other explanations out there, but theirs is, in order to ride in traffic, you must become traffic. Very simple, right? So another one that I've heard, and I don't think this came from the league, I believe I read it somewhere else, and it was, you need to stop thinking about riding your bicycle and start thinking about driving your bicycle. That's a big one right there, because if you take your bicycle and you use it like a vehicle when you're in traffic, so as you would if you were driving a motorized vehicle, and react the same way, and get out there in the lanes when you need to be in the lanes, make yourself very visible when you're riding, you will be a lot safer, and people will understand what it is you're doing, not just being off on the far right-hand side of the road and being in their way, as they tend to say to us. So there's a piece from Bicycling Magazine once again, and it is, watch how to make a safe left-hand turn in traffic. Of course, you can't watch it because there's a video that goes along with this, but we're just going to talk about it instead. So making a left turn in traffic, especially when outside of a dedicated turning lane, can be a tricky maneuver on a bike. There are a few solid ways to responsibly make this turn and ensure drivers are aware of your presence. So there's a piece here that says, follow these steps while riding in traffic to make things safer. On quiet roads, look behind you for a clear break in the traffic that would give you enough time to position yourself safely to make the left turn. Plan ahead. You should be looking behind you at least 25 yards before reaching the intersection, or you risk running out of road. If that happens, stop on the shoulder or curb until it's safe to continue. And that creates a confusion when you do that. If you have to pull over to the right-hand side to make that left-hand turn, you are sending such an incredibly mixed message to the driver of the motorized vehicle. They just don't know if you're going to dart out. They don't know if you're going to try to get across in front of them. They really don't know what you're doing. So become traffic. Back to that League of American Bicyclists rule. In order to ride in traffic, you must become traffic. So if you're in a situation where you're going to make that left-hand turn up the road, you sense that there are cars behind you, or you've looked in your mirror to see cars behind you, or you've looked over your shoulder to see that there are cars approaching, they may be coming up on you fast. Put your arm out. Get out in the middle of the road. I tend to tell people to ride that center line if there's a center line there, because if they need to get around you because they're going straight or they need to make a right-hand turn at the same intersection, you will give them plenty of room in which to do that. So get yourself out there. Indicate what you're doing. Communicate with the driver of the motorized vehicle so that they understand what it is that is going on, and then you both can share the road together. So when you see a break, you signal your intention to make that left turn, as I just said. If you see an oncoming driver or a driver approaching slowly from behind, wait for confirmation that the driver sees you. They may blink their lights, they may wave, they may slow down or hold eye contact. If the driver doesn't slow or acknowledge you, wait until the vehicle has passed for another break in traffic. Once again, great if you wait for the break in traffic, but you may not be in a situation where you're able to do that. I believe that you're still safer getting out there and getting their attention that way. They will see you if you're in the middle of the road. Drivers of automobiles and trucks have a very difficult time seeing you when you're on the right-hand side of the road because they aren't used to looking there. That's not where they're going to look to see a bicycle, to see a motor vehicle or to see a motorcycle. That's not where they're going to look. Take a little tip from those that ride motorcycles and have stayed safe over the years. You see them oftentimes very close to the center line when they're out in the road. The reason they're on that center line or very close to it is because they can be seen there. They cannot be seen on the right-hand side of the road because drivers of motorized vehicles are generally not looking there. So you need to make sure you get yourself in their view. So I'm not a real big believer of pulling over to the side of the road and waiting for traffic to go by because I think it really sends a mixed message and you should be awfully careful about doing that. It's not really what I have in mind. You want to move to the center of the left turn lane if there is one or to the left third of the travel lane. So again, I like to head right out there. If there's a center line available, that's where I want to be. I want to have my wheels as close to that center line as possible because everybody can see me there. And these were for low traffic roads. On high traffic roads, the suggestions here are avoid having to merge by using the two-step maneuver known as the Copenhagen or box turn. Copenhagen or box turn, that's interesting. I'm not sure I'm aware of that. Fran, you might want to look that one up for me.
Is that the same as the Dutch reach?
Well, I don't know. That's, you know, we keep pulling these guys, that poor country into this, into this the bicycle rules game here.
Well, Holland is not Denmark.
Well, that's true. But they're very close to one another, and they're all over in Europe where a lot more people ride bicycles than do here. So if you could look that up, Copenhagen or box turn, that's interesting. So anyway, it says ride straight through the intersection and then stop your bike at the opposite street corner. Turn your bike in the direction you want to go and proceed straight across the intersection in that direction once you have the right of way. Using these methods should keep you safe out of the roads, just all out on the roads. As always, just remember to take your time and stay aware of your surroundings.
That's interesting.
So
what do you think of that?
So talk to me. What is this Copenhagen or box turn? What is that?
That's what it is. It's what you just said. So you're riding along a road.
Yeah.
In a right lane.
Mm-hmm.
And you're so then you say, for example, you're coming to a four-way intersection.
Mm-hmm.
You stay to the right, you cross the intersection to the nearest corner as though you're going to go straight in the intersection. But then you stop at the corner, then you turn your bike while you're stopped to face, you know, the left turn direction, and then you cross that way, still staying to the right. So you never get out into the middle of the road and you don't make a classic left hand turn like a car would. Or get into the left lane. You always stay to the right.
That would not work here.
You don't think?
I do not.
No.
I do not. People, when they see you on the right-hand side of that road, they assume that they're in charge. They are not looking for you to make a left-hand turn if you're on the right-hand
lane. No, but what you're going to do is you're going to cross the intersection, stop at the opposite corner, and then turn your bike and cross the intersection in that direction. That's what they mean. It's an interesting idea.
Is it keeps you out of the middle of the road?
Is
it assuming that there's a stoplight or a stop sign?
It doesn't matter.
It just doesn't make a lot of sense.
It doesn't matter. Mm. So although the issue is if there's, for example, if there's a left turn lane with a left arrow, if you do that as a vehicle, you're basically breaking the traffic law. And bicycles are supposed to follow traffic laws, right? So if I want to make a left turn off of 195 onto Bassett's Bridge Road, And I'm following traffic laws. I want to get as far to the left as is comfortable.
Absolutely.
And I have to wait for the left arrow to signal me to go. That's the law.
That is correct.
Also, or I can stand there if the light is green and the left arrow has passed, but the light's still green. I then stay there in the middle of the road and wait for the oncoming cars to go. And then I make a left turn while holding my arm out to signal left. That's the law.
That's correct.
So if I were to instead, now there have been times when I have gotten stuck and I haven't been able to get into the middle of the road and necessity forced me to do that at that spot where I would be riding along on the right side there and there was just so much traffic I couldn't get into the middle of the road. So I wound up on the right-hand side of the road at the intersection having to then turn my bike to face left and wait until it was safe to cross.
Right.
So I've done it by necessity at times.
Sure.
But that's not the law.
Right.
The law is like you follow traffic laws.
The law is you get out there in that lane, command your lane.
Right.
That's really what it is.
Well, the law is that we're a vehicle and we follow the same rules that vehicles follow.
Absolutely. Going back to the old explanation of drive your bicycle.
Yeah.
Don't think about riding your bicycle. Think about driving your bicycle. So in a situation like that, let's say you're in that situation that Fran was in. Let's say there's 10 cars that are coming up behind you and, you know, you have a traffic light coming up and it may be changing and turning into red. It may not be. You need to point your way into between a couple of cars. And
sometimes it's not feasible, though.
It's aggressive and it's difficult. And sometimes you just have to do it. And what you're going to find in most cases is if you do that and you're making eye contact with the driver of that motorized vehicle, they'll let you in.
Lots of times they will, but you just never know. I mean, most of the time at that intersection, when I'm trying to turn left into Bassett's Bridge Road, I don't have a problem. I get into the middle lane. Somebody lets me in or there's, you know, I'm at a time of day where I'm able to get over. Even when there's a line of traffic, there's usually a spot for me to safely get in.
There's usually a little gap you can sneak in there.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep,
but
exactly.
Once in a while it happens. If it's really, really busy, there's just no way to get in because there's no left turn lane there, really.
Right.
It's a single lane road. But so that's the issue. So it happens. So that Copenhagen left happens. Sometimes. So is it saying that a rule in Copenhagen?
I don't know. I don't know. I just it just calls it a two-step maneuver known as the Copenhagen or back or box.
Yes.
Box turn
because there's turn cue boxes. That's it depends on oh, well, it looks like it's bike rule. There are biking rules in Denmark.
Well, as there should be. There's a lot of bicycles there.
So this may be one of the rules.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe that's it. I don't know. It's certainly, something to consider.
Look at this. So I have a list of biking rules in Denmark, and it says here, when turning left at an intersection, ride on the right side of the path through the intersection, signal your stop, and stop on the opposite side. Here you wait until the light turns green in your new direction. That's the law in Denmark.
Really?
That's why it's called a Copenhagen left. And it's called a box turn because some places they have boxes where you stand to wait for your turn. Two-stage turn cue boxes. So National Association of City Transportation Officials. Two-stage turn cue boxes offer bicyclists a safe way to make left turns at multi-lane signalized intersections from the right side cycle track or bike lane or right turns from a left side cycle track or bike lane. Two-stage turn cue boxes may also be used at unsignaled intersections to simplify turns from a bicycle lane. This National Association of City Transportation Officials, I'm not sure what nation this is. Let me see if I can find it. I mean, it is in English, and they're spelling signalized with a Z, so it may be the United States. Oh, it is the United States. This National Association of City Transportation Officials. This is the U.S., anyway, there's photographs here showing the boxes. It's very interesting. There's a like a green box where you wait. So it's a brightly green painted box where you wait to make your turn.
I'll have to explore that because I'm not aware of it.
Yes.
I'm not aware of that, but that would be something to look at. Basically, if you go for the general rule here, the general rule is in order to ride in traffic is to become traffic and to be traffic. So I think that that would be a good way to look at this as you know, making any turns, right turns, left turns, whatever. Take your lane. I say it all the time. People who ride with me know it. They hear it all the time. I always say, take the lane. And we take the lane. If there's a multiple number of us and we have, let's say, a half a dozen or even more cyclists and we take the lane, the cars are pretty much put in a place where they need to, they'll see you and you'll be safer amongst the numbers. So anyway, I have the last thing on the list here is upcoming events, and I want to push the Connecticut Series of Cross once again because it is near and dear to me, and the 2017 schedule is available. You can go online to ctseriesofcx.com, and you can find out more about that. But coming up on November 4th, which is this weekend, we have Cheshire Cross in Cheshire, Connecticut on November 5th. We have the Newtown Team 26 Cross and in Newtown, Connecticut. On the 24th of March, we have the March Farms Cross, which is in Bethlehem, Connecticut. And on December 17th in New Haven, the final race of the series, the Elm City Cross in New Haven, Connecticut. Please keep in mind also that the annual dinner for Connecticut Bike Walk is this Friday, November 3rd. I talked about that earlier. You can go on to the website and check with them, and you will be able to find more information about that. So that would be at www.bikewalkct.org. Check out the annual dinner. Doors open at 5:30 on Friday, November 3rd. At the very end, we have the silent auction, which is also there too, which is kind of a cool thing. There's some neat little goodies you can get yourself affiliated with if you wish and bid on. And then there's also the People's Choice Awards. So if you have someone within your cycling community, within our cycling community here in Connecticut that you would like to honor or nominate for the award, just go to their website and you can click on the nomination link and you can put your favorite person into the list. My name is Pedlin Ron. You've been listening to Bicycle Talk with my co-host, Fran Storch, a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. You can send me an email at bicycletalk1@gmail.com, and you can also listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org or on iTunes. If you'd like to contribute to or be on the show as a guest, please contact me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. This is Pedlin Ron. Remember, keep the rubber side down and the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS, Storrs. Thank you for listening.